This week on Capitalism, Race, and Democracy.
These workers are strike in many places in this country, and we need to bring all those workers together with organized labor.
Longshore workers shut down terminals from Los Angeles to Seattle.
I'm over here in Palmdale, California, where Amazon workers have just unionized with Local 396.
We're here to show Amazon that we are staying. They are not going to push us away.
Amazon workers are fighting for unionization throughout the country.
The African government has a number of powerful legal arguments available to it, which suggest that it is not obliged to arrest President Putin.
South Africa resists the International Criminal Court's demand that they arrest Russian President Vladimir Putin if he travels to Cape Town for the BRICS conference.
I say no to U.S. imperialism, because the only acceptable answer to the U.S. is more war, more war, more war, support Ukraine to the hilt, and don't you dare talk about peace.
The U.S. is discouraging peace talks in the Ukraine war. From Pacifica Radio, this is Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Ann Garrison. For those of you who have been listening to COVID, Race, and Democracy, we have changed our name to Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. We will continue to cover COVID, but we've reimagined ourselves as we broadened our coverage over the 3 years we've been broadcasting. Now, on with the show. On May 10th, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis signed into law Florida Senate Bill 1718. The bill will require employers to use the E-Verify system to verify employees' immigration status and will impose criminal penalties on individuals transporting undocumented immigrants into Florida. On June 1st, National Day Without Immigrants rallies were held around the country to protest the Florida bill. Immigrants and their allies spoke out in San Francisco.
I'm here for the people that can't speak, for the unheard.
We are tired. We are tired. All we are asking for is equity and human rights. We are native to this land, y si se puede. Thank you, si se puede.
Hi, my name is Yalimar Espinosa Jimenez, and my parents are immigrants. I'm a citizen. And I am here to be the voice of my parents that can't be here right now because one of them is deported. And deportation really does take a mental toll on their kids. So I'm here to be their voice.
Si se puede! Si se puede!
My name is Rosa Dalila Madueno. Gosh. Every day I wake up, I look at the news. Then there's been murders, school shootings. They say that America is the land of the free, but it's the land of war right now. What I really want to talk about is this. My friends come up to me, they say, I'm going to Florida. You want to come with me? And I say, heck no.
My name is Claudia Laquaita. I'm representing from Oakland, California, Yaqui Pride. I'm not Mexican, I'm indigenous, let's get that right. This is our land, it's been our land. We're living in a brown continent, and it's time for us to live.
La raza unida jamás será vencida. La raza unida jamás será vencida.
It is really important, brothers and sisters, that we understand when we said immigrants build this country, yes, Italian immigrants build this country. Irish immigrants built this country. European immigrants built this country. Asian immigrants built this country. African immigrants built this country. Slavery built this country. It was the basis of becoming rich of this country, a big imperialist country. It was slavery. We need to understand, brothers and sisters, that unless we recognize that this is a working class struggle, that we gotta be together with all workers of all colors, nothing can happen. It's not only about la raza, it's about the working class.
Yeah.
need to unite and we need to stop people from using us. Because all those non-profits get money by saying that they're helping us. They get money and they sell us out. Todas esas non-profits cogen dinero para hablar por nosotros y nos venden. Venden nuestra lucha. So we need to unite, brothers and sisters. Let us get it clear. Yes, immigrants build this country. European, African, Asians, Latino Americans, all of us build this country. And we need to unite. We need to unite. We cannot let them divide us anymore. That is my message to you all today. We need to unite, brothers and sisters. We need, and when these brothers that have organized this whole thing about the banks are the ones that control everything, controlan todos estos hijos de su madre. They control everything. And they're the ones who have us where we are at. Y son los que nos tienen a donde estamos. Por eso tenemos que abrir los ojos. Si queremos ganar, tenemos que abrir los ojos. Tenemos que abrir los ojos y unirnos como clase trabajadora. If we want to win, we need to open our eyes and unite as a working class. I don't care what anybody tells me. That's the only thing that can help us to get out of the mess that we are in. Porque estamos bajo un fascismo. Ustedes no lo creen, pero piénsenlo bien. Estamos listos a entrar a una guerra, una tercera guerra mundial, y ni siquiera entendemos eso. We are so blind, they blind us so much that we're ready to go on a third world war and we don't even realize that. Mm-hmm. We don't even realize that. That's how bad it is. That's why we need to unite, brothers and sisters.
That was a National Day Without Immigrants rally held in San Francisco to protest Florida's anti-immigrant bill 1718. Was One Love by Manu Chao and Playing for Change. Stevedoring employers are firing members of the International Longshore Workers Union in Seattle and other West Coast ports. On Saturday, June 2nd, longshoremen shut down terminals in ports from Los Angeles to Seattle. Pacifica's Steve Seltzer spoke to Gabriel Prawl, past president of Seattle ILWU Local 52 and current president of the A. Philip Randolph Institute.
Well, the reality is longshore workers have been working against all odds. If we remind ourselves COVID-19 in 2020 and the extreme need for essential workers to continue working to make sure that the supplies enter the ports and reach the stores and even to the necessity of people in the country. And these are sacrifices that workers did. Many of them died in the process, even members of my own local, 52. But now we've been about a year now without a contract. And we're still fighting to get a fair contract. And I was under the impression everything was okay. But now it seems like the employees want us to work as normal as we've been working for, I could say, from the beginning of the past contract. But they don't want to resolve in giving us what we deserve as workers to keep up with the rise in the price of food and gas and all this stuff like that. They want to not only not pay us enough, but they don't want to give us no amount of that we deserve to keep up with the economy and on the change of what's going on in this country. And today, workers are working safe, doing their job. Employers decide to fire everyone. It started last night. And while for whatever excuse they want to use, it doesn't make any sense because workers have been working without a contract for about a year now in June.
And the health and safety conditions on the docks are very dangerous. Dock workers are killed. for speed. They speed up. And it seems like this is a real problem of health and safety for dock workers.
But the reality is dock workers have been trying to do everything to please the employee while they've been in constant negotiation. They have done more than they're supposed to do, I should say. And the employees refuse to be generous to the workers by compensating them for the hard work they do. And I believe that workers have gone above and beyond past contract in the manner of all they work. I know we are following the contract and working safe. I'm not violating any safety rules. And employers took that as a way to attack the workers. So not only they don't want to pay the workers the right thing, not only they don't want to negotiate in good faith, but they want to take away everything that we have worked so hard to gain.
And at the same time, the profits of these shipping companies have been massive during the COVID thing. They were making a lot of money. Isn't that the case?
That's exactly the case. So there's no reason why workers shouldn't be getting compensated properly, getting raised like they should to keep up with their cost of living. They should be getting all the benefit. They need to be healthy on the job. And I think that there's no reason why the employers shouldn't negotiate in good faith with the union.
And the issue of automation and technology, right now there are 11,000 writers going on strike. The Screen Actors Guild are taking a strike vote. They want to use AI to destroy their conditions, to replace them. I understand it's the same thing in the longshore industry, that they want to use AI to get rid of dock workers. Is that true?
That's correct. Automation has been a big, big problem for workers. It eliminates jobs, and there's no way to compensate the workers. In fact, it eliminates workers. I mean, this is happening in every field that you can think on. AI is a very dangerous thing, very dangerous for workers, very dangerous for humanity as a whole, because now this can turn against the whole country, the whole world.
It seems that the bosses, the capitalists, want to bring this in. They don't want any regulation of it, and they want to use it to increase their profits. But if it results in millions of workers, and Goldman Sachs said 300 million workers may lose their job, what is the future of workers if the bosses are in control of this technology and it's not benefiting workers?
You know, Steve, like, this has to make some sense. It has to make some sense because the employers make money when people can purchase the product. If there's no workers to earn money, how can they purchase the product? So it doesn't make sense, the idea that they have to eliminate workers, but they want to use artificial intelligence to do the work. Yeah, you don't have to pay the artificial intelligence, but all the workers going to buy your product. Or people going to be purchasing the food, autos, basic things that a person needs. And able to afford that, you have to have a job. If you don't have a job, then the products stay on the shelf. So it doesn't make any kind of sense to eliminate workers, but still produce products.
Since you don't have a contract, the employers have used this as an opportunity to get rid of ILWU members. Is that true? And bring in IAM, bring in other unions to replace ILWU workers?
It's always going to be a fight where we have that, where they put workers against workers. This is the old tools of the bosses. They put workers against workers, but at the end, none of us workers benefit from it. And that's why workers need to come together, and we need to not raid each other's jurisdiction, because we only serving the bosses when we do that. And they enjoy it. They pit us against each other, and that's how they get rid of all of us, because today they come for me, tomorrow they're coming for you.
We're coming up onto Juneteenth. It seems like they want to continue slavery, these racist attacks, the laws passed in Florida against immigrants, taking out history books that talk about this history of slavery in this country. What is the general situation workers are facing in this country?
Juneteenth is a great day for black to celebrate. We got that Juneteenth federal holiday, but this is just a legislative win. It's just a legislative win for people and workers. But slavery has not ended in this country. It has not. As long as people are not making livable wages, as long as people are homeless, as long as people are not having the health care and the basic needs for a human being, we're still in slavery. Many of our workers are still living in slavery. And the fact that they're trying to take us back, where they want to use child labor, using 13 years old kids to work in factory. They're bringing it back again. We fought that in the past, and here we are going back to this. So this is the type of mentality that we're dealing with right now, a mentality of bosses and CEO that does not have no concern for any worker, even less by our kids. They are directing us right back to years of struggle to change things in this country, and we have to come together as workers. And I'm talking about every worker. That's why we're calling on Juneteenth. We want every worker to come out and join together and show the force. We have to show our force as workers and the power that we have to change things. We have been sleeping too long and not exercising that power, and it's time to bring it up, because there's workers on strike in many places in this country, and we need to bring all those workers together with organized labor.
And the history of general strikes in the United States, the last one was in 1946 in Oakland. There was a general strike. There haven't been general strikes since that time. The ILWU was formed out of a general strike in 1934. There was a West Coast maritime strike, and workers were killed in Seattle and San Francisco. Two workers were killed. Do you think general strike movement is coming back in this country? Because it seems like many of these strikes, as you were talking about, are around the same issues.
I think that's what it's going to take to change. We got to go back to the basic. We have a blueprint to make it happen. We need to pull that blueprint out and exercise the tools and the organizing skill that it's going to take to make this change. Because right now, workers been fighting alone by themselves, and they don't have to. We have to make it clear. Workers in this era should not have to walk and fight alone. Labor needs to come in strong, and we need to show the power that we have to change things. Can you imagine if workers take a day off all around the world? That will show a powerful example of the power that labor has.
That was Seattle longshore worker Gabriel Perall speaking to Pacifica's Steve Seltzer.
Criminal minded, we've been blinded, looking for an honest job and can't find it. They got a job bill, we got a light bill. If we don't pay ours, our life is quite real.
That was Work Every Day by Brother Ali. Amazon workers are fighting to unionize throughout the country. In Palmdale, California, Teamsters who were working for subcontractors are rallying against union busting. They talked about their struggle on Raider and the Saint, a podcast by Teamster Stephen Gexiola, who is a member of Teamsters Local 952.
I'm over here in Palmdale, California, where Amazon workers have just unionized with Local 396.
Thank you guys for being here with us in support of Amazon. They've definitely gotten a lot of their hours taken away. So we're here to show Amazon that we are staying. They are not going to push us away. We are a union. We stay together in solidarity. They are part of our local. They're Local 396. They're union brothers officially. They have a contract. They're at first, the company started retaliating, started what they call grounding their vehicles, where they don't let them use the vehicles. Then after that, they start cutting their routes, and that's what we're facing right now. Amazon starts giving out the routes to other DSPs, other independent contractors out here, and it's definitely affecting their livelihood, their families. You know, they need to pay bills just like everybody else. And I know that this is a form of retaliation where Amazon doesn't even want us on the parking lot, but we're there because we're representing our members now, so we can be in the parking lot. But they, every single morning, we get harassed by them. I know you guys are here with the members, but you guys can't be in the parking lot. It's like, what? That's crazy. We're not doing anything. We've already done the every Wednesday, and because of the things that are happening now, we have to show the company that we're here. This just happened on Friday. We had a meeting on Saturday where they pretty much told us that they're taking away another 8 routes. So that's why we're here. We're here to support them, to let them know that even though Amazon is retaliating, taking their work away, that we're backing them up.
Amazon, they're like FedEx. They subcontract the drivers. So you get one guy who wants to be the boss of 100 drivers. He gets the contract from Amazon, and then he subcontract. Basically, it's called subcontracting.
Yes.
So the big thing we want here is we want all of Amazon to be unionized.
This is Big Will out of Local 396. I'm a driver out of Whittier Center, 30-year veteran. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I'm here supporting the Amazon drivers, man. Mm-hmm. You know, it's important that we organize these guys and bring them on board with us, man. Like, pretty much the whole summer since the news came out broke. And it's just going to grow, man. I mean, mm-hmm. this is the epicenter of the labor movement right here. Mm-hmm. And we're going to be out here as long as it takes. For this to be happening right now, especially because the labor movement is really hot. Mm-hmm. And we're just going to see more and more actions across the country. We're going to see strikes. You're seeing the Hollywood writer strike. You're seeing SAG is going to go out on strike. We have ours. Our big contract is going to expire July 31st. The movement is going to take off. Mm-hmm. You know, this is the epicenter. And this is where all of our focus should be. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Right here. In Palmdale, we're going to make it happen.
Spending a Sunday morning on the picket like no other place to be. Right now, they're going to go through some dark days. Because Amazon is just relentless, and Amazon's already cutting routes. They're going to let people go. They started letting people go. And it's just going to get more dark. And then you're going to have people questioning the union. So is this really worth it? But, you know, we have to be honest with them. And we have to tell them this is what's going to happen. And good thing in 396 is their jurisdiction's L.A., so they have the LA Fed, and LA Fed has programs in place to help workers as what's going to happen right here in Palmdale.
Yeah.
So that's a good thing, but
because they're slowly starting to take their work away, right?
Yes, and starting to let them go. But you see, if the subcontractor's not firing you, but Amazon is firing you, so it's really a joint employer. It's not a subcontractor.
Yeah.
Like how Amazon likes to portray itself. Oh, no, we... These are not our employees. Well, okay, so if they're not your employees, why are you firing them? Why are you disciplining them? Mm-hmm. So it's just things that we have to combat in the public, and then be truthful with the DSP drivers out here, mm-hmm. and tell them that you will face the dark days, but we have to stay with them.
Kind of like what Medieval Times is going through right now.
Yeah, yeah. They're both camps are holding firm, and I just heard Jake say that. By no means is that strike line going to stop in Medieval Times. Mm. Same thing here. No way these guys and girls are going to, guys and ladies, excuse me, are going to stop. They're fighting for something greater for them. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, unfortunately, we're going to hit the dark days.
Yeah.
But we're going to come out on the other side. UPS, they signed a non-disclosure agreement, which is a gag order.
They done that before, though, in the past?
My understanding, no.
No, huh?
So that's something new, so they really can't say anything about the contract. But, I mean, that discussion's going to happen.
Yeah.
And, you know, however it shakes out, you know. Amazon's going to retaliate against them. And then if you go to Inland Empire, you have the other Amazon facility that's, you know, that's unionizing as well. So they're doing some days of action over there. And ONT8, mm-hmm. what I call Aunt 8, you know, they're doing things there. And then if you live in San Diego, Local 542, I believe, mm-hmm. they have the TransDev like we do, like OCX is in Orange County, mm-hmm. like we do, but mm-hmm. they have probably call it something else. But they're on a picket line as well. So regardless of where you go in Southern California, there's a picket line, you know.
Yeah.
We just need more people engaged, you know.
Yeah.
We can't be sitting back no more. Those days of this laid-back Californian attitude.
Well, we didn't get to where we were because we were laid back. We went out there, we picketed, we rallied, we organized, and now it's time that we got to do it again because
like the 1930s, 1920s, 1910s, 1900s, early 19th century, labor was very active back then. Mm-hmm. Very, very active.
And now, it's been quiet for many years, and now it's 90, starting to pick up
again.
Yeah,
in the 90s, there was an uptick, especially with the 97 strike at UPS, which was probably the biggest one at that time.
Those were Teamsters on Raider and the Saint, a podcast produced by Teamster Stephen Gaxiola, a member of Teamsters Local 952. Their action outside Amazon in Palmdale, California is ongoing. We got your one. We're at the gates. We're at your door. Hey, you. We got your one. We're at the That was The Guillotine by The Coup. You're listening to Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Ann Garrison. Russian President Vladimir Putin is scheduled to represent Russia at a conference of the BRICS nations, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, in South Africa in August. However, the plan has become controversial there because the country is a state party to the International Criminal Court and might therefore be expected to arrest Putin, whom the court indicted in March for crimes in Ukraine. Putin and Russian Commissioner for Children's Rights, Maria Lvova-Belova, are the first and only white people to be indicted by the court. All 44 of those previously indicted have been Africans. Nevertheless, 33 African nations, including South Africa, are still states parties to the court and thereby accept its jurisdiction. However, the African Union has asked its member nations not to cooperate with the court. I spoke to David Paul Jacobs, a Canadian attorney with experience in international law. David, what everyone thinks of the ICC and its obvious hypocrisies, this indictment has the world's attention, and it's awkward for South Africa. Can you explain their legal position? What does the Rome Statute say?
Well, I think before we get into that, it's important to place this all into context. So the context is there's an armed conflict going on in Ukraine, and the actors, Russia, the Ukrainian government, and Ukrainian government being supported by NATO countries. And there's a division about this. The NATO countries want the rest of the world to enthusiastically support them. But at the same time, there have been a number of peace efforts going on from a variety of ideologically diverse sources. China, Brazil, Israel, at one point, and Indonesia. They're all trying to promote peace. So after a year of armed conflict, and when there are a lot of signals that countries want to have a diplomatic resolution to this crisis, all of a sudden, we have the announcement that there is a, as yet, as I understand it, secret indictment against the sitting head of state, President Putin, and that there is an arrest warrant out for him by the International Criminal Court. So this is problematic. I mean, it's problematic because there is an armed conflict going on, and the risk that the International Criminal Court runs into, and it's a serious risk, is generating a reasonable apprehension that this is a biased court. In fact, just a couple of weeks before the arrest warrant was announced, that was on March 17th, 2023, the chief prosecutor is quoted as saying, of course, the prosecutor of the International Criminal Court does not, whatever affection and regard I may have for my dear friends in Ukraine, has no special affinity to any particular country. We're not a party to any hostilities. And the problematic is that in the middle of an armed conflict, to raise a claim that the president of one of the parties to the conflict, that is Russia, is a war criminal, directly contradicts any peace efforts. Once you've branded somebody as a war criminal, it's exceptionally difficult to move back and engage in diplomatic efforts. In fact, U.S. commentators in the Foreign Policy Journal have stated quite bluntly that this is a great opportunity. It draws a line in the sand between illiberal countries, i.e. Russia, and liberal countries, and forces people to take sides. Well, to be honest with you, I don't see that as being the role of a court. Justice is not blind in those circumstances. It really brings the administration of justice, at least international justice, into disrepute in this respect. So where does South Africa stand? Well, South Africa politically and economically is a member of an organization called BRICS, which is an organization of cooperation between Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, and has invited Russia to a BRICS summit, invited the President Putin to a BRICS summit, which is going to be held in Cape Town in August of this year. So the South African government is likely being told by the International Criminal Court that there's an arrest warrant out for the president of Russia, and that there is an obligation on South Africa to cooperate with the International Criminal Court and its arrest warrant. And the Rome Statute, that is the agreement between the nations who signed the statute to put together and be bound by the International Criminal Court. Those signatories, by the way, at the moment do not include the United States, China, Russia, and some other countries, including Burundi. So that obligation is an obligation under the authority of the International Criminal Court to make requests to states parties for cooperation. Now, The question is, what's the legal situation for South Africa, having given you the context? And the legal situation for South Africa is that they have an obligation to cooperate with the International Criminal Court as long as they're a member of that court. Although in 2016, South Africa declared an intention to withdraw from the Rome Statute, but later has reversed itself. But the obligation to cooperate with that court is tempered by Article 98 of the Rome Statute, which says, I won't read the whole thing, but I'll try and give you the gist of it. The court may not proceed with a request for surrender in this case of the person to whom the arrest warrant applies, that is President Putin and one other person. The court may not proceed with a request for surrender or assistance, which would require the requested state, South Africa in this case, to act inconsistently with its obligations under international law with respect to the state or diplomatic immunity of a person or property of a third state, assuming now that the third state is South Africa. So unpacking that, the obligation to cooperate is subject to South Africa's obligations under international law. And let me just tell you what they are. The obligation under international law would include South Africa's obligations to its fellow nations within the African Union, which resolved in 2015 that heads of state would be granted immunity from international criminal court prosecution. So there is that. Additionally, South Africa's own law, a law called the Diplomatic Immunities and Privileges Act 2001, applies. And many countries, I'm sure the United States too, but Canada as well, have similar enactments to protect and provide immunity for foreign heads of state who are visiting. Otherwise, we'd have international anarchy. If there's an arrest warrant for a visiting head of state in one territory, the head of state of that territory would be vulnerable to an arrest warrant in another territory. And it can't be how the world works, and it would lead to very predictably and possibly very dangerous results. So that enactment, the South African law, protects heads of state and diplomatic personnel from arrest and so on. The South African government has now explicitly invoked the Diplomatic Immunities and Privileges Act 2001 to apply to the BRICS summit in South Africa in August 2023. And let me add another element to this mix. I said a little earlier that most countries have this kind of reciprocal protection for visiting heads of state. But the United States has gone a little bit further. The United States, as I've said, is not a party to the Rome Statute, but enacted its own legislation. I think it's called the American Service Members Protection Act. I think you've described it as a Hague Invasion Act. But that is a bill to protect U.S. military personnel and other elected and appointed officials of the United States government, to protect them against criminal prosecution by an international criminal court to which the U.S. is not a party. It was a bill introduced by Republican Jesse Helms, and it's enacted in law. It permits the president to even use military force to free any U.S. personnel otherwise held by the court. So this is the context, and there is an obvious argument for the South African government that by virtue of Section 98 of the Rome Statute, even though it's a signatory to the Rome Statute, it is not obliged to arrest a sitting head of state.
Now, South Africa's leading opposition party, the Democratic Alliance, is asking a court to order South African police to arrest Putin. Do you have any thoughts about how that might play out?
Well, I don't know how things would work in a South African court. All I can tell you is the South African government has a number of powerful legal arguments available to it, which suggest that it is not obliged to arrest President Putin, given its domestic law, given its obligations to the African Union, and frankly, given a common understanding of international law, which would say that there's an internationally recognized right of immunity for heads of state, sitting heads of state.
Yeah, it's probably worth noting that in either 2015 or 2016, Omar al-Bashir was in South Africa, and this party got a court to order his arrest, and then he left the country. He left the country before the decision.
Right. But I don't pretend to be an expert in the South African legal system, so I couldn't comment further on that one.
Okay. 33 African nations, including South Africa, are states parties to the court. Given that the court has indicted 44 Africans, and up to now, no one from another continent, Do you think they should all withdraw from the court? Would that make sense?
They're sovereign nations, so they can do as they will. A large number of nations, over 100, are signatories to the Rome Statute. Some have withdrawn after signing, including, I believe, the United States, although I'm not sure it ever fully affiliated to the court.
No, it never ratified. The United States never ratified.
Right, I think the sign didn't ratify and pulled back under George Bush. But Burundi has pulled out of the court, and as I said in the past, South Africa has been musing about it at the very least for some time. But the African Union, to which South Africa is a member, has instructed member countries not to cooperate with the International Criminal Court. So it remains to be seen what African countries will do. I would say that the more the court acts in a political fashion or appears to act in a political fashion, the more unattractive the court will be to countries that don't want to get embroiled in the politics.
Okay, regarding the indictment of Putin and Lvovlev itself, I know that Ukraine's bombing of its own Russian-speaking population, its disregard for the Minsk Accords, and perhaps even its desire to join NATO make a moral case for Russia's invasion of Ukraine, but it's still a crime of aggression, a violation of Ukraine's sovereignty, isn't it?
Well, let's be really clear. As far as we know, we haven't seen the indictment yet, and we haven't even seen the arrest warrant. We've been told it exists. But the arrest warrant for President Putin does not accuse him of the crime of aggression. So that's number one. So we're now talking about something which President Putin does not have to defend himself from. He doesn't have to defend himself from an accusation of crime of aggression. The crime which he's accused of is a form of crime against humanity. That is the abduction of children. That's the nature of the offense which is alleged, as I understand it. So putting that to one side, in terms of the crime of aggression, let me just say a little bit about that. Under the Nuremberg Tribunal, there were three types of crimes that were prosecuted. Crimes against the peace, which is the crime of aggression. And what that means is planning, initiating, waging wars of aggression in violation of international treaties and agreements. And the other two crimes are crimes against humanity and war crimes. And the Nuremberg Tribunal rather famously said that to initiate a war of aggression is not only an international crime, it is a supreme international crime, differing only from other war crimes in that it contains within itself the accumulated evil of the whole. And I believe that was a statement from U.S. Justice Robert Jackson, who was a prosecutor on the court. Why do I say that? Because the International Criminal Tribunals established prior to the International Criminal Court did not have any power to adjudicate crimes of aggression, crimes against the peace. And the International Criminal Court has only very recently added the crime of aggression to its jurisdiction in 2017, but it does not apply to a state which isn't a party. The Rome Statute says clearly, in respect of a state that's not a party to the Rome Statute, the court shall not exercise its jurisdiction over the crime of aggression when committed by that state's nationals on its territory. So let me go slightly further on this. The problem with focusing on the armed conflict in Ukraine, it commenced in February 2022. They specifically talk about Russia's involvement, because Russia would argue that the armed conflict started in 2014 when there was armed action against the areas of Ukraine which were attempting to become independent, Donbass, Luhansk, and Crimea. So prior to that, though, there had been a number of armed invasions of countries, but particularly by the United States and NATO. I'm thinking about, there's a longish list, Yugoslavia, Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, the list goes on and on. And why am I mentioning those? Because armed military action can only take place lawfully within the meaning of the United Nations Charter, with either the approval of the United Nations Security Council, under Chapter 7 of the United Nations Charter, which allows the Security Council to authorize military action in the case that the United Nations Security Council finds that a state is acting in a manner which creates a danger to international peace and security. The only other instance in which armed conflict is lawful is by a state acting in self-defense, even anticipatory self-defense, of an imminent and necessary threat. And one would assume that if there was a charge of aggression, Russia may seek to defend itself under Section 51 of the Charter, UN Charter, which provides that individual or collective self-defense in the face of an armed attack is lawful.
What was the article you cited there, the article in the Charter?
51.
Okay, David Jacobs, thank you for speaking to Pacifica Radio.
Thank you very much indeed.
That was Hugh Masekela and his band at Billingen Global Carnival 2009. This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Ann Garrison. As South Africa and China advocated for peace in Ukraine, Ukrainian President Vladimir Zelensky embarked on a tour to secure additional weapons, including a stop at the Group of Seven summit held in Hiroshima. Brian Becker, host of the Socialist Program on Breakthrough News and National Director of the Answer Coalition, discussed the current juncture of the conflict in Ukraine. He spoke to Breakthrough News hosts Eugene Puryear and Rania Kalik.
When you think about what happened with Hiroshima and Nagasaki, bombs dropped just a few days apart in 1945, it wasn't mainly to defeat Japan. Japan was about to surrender no matter what. It was the opening shot of the Cold War, the war between the United States and world capitalism against what was then the Soviet Union. Here we are, many, many decades later, the same capitalist countries meeting in Hiroshima, again, preparing for war, literally preparing for war, not any longer with the Soviet Union per se, but with Russia, which was, of course, the anchoring republic in the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. You know, sometimes the imperialists who used these weapons of mass destruction killed hundreds of thousands of civilians. Again, Hiroshima and Nagasaki were not bombed earlier so that the U.S. could have a clean laboratory type experiment to see what the damage would be if an atomic bomb was dropped on human beings. And so these civilian cities, Hiroshima and Nagasaki, who again had been exempted from earlier bombing campaigns, were destroyed in a moment. These same imperialists are sort of holding their hand to their heart and worrying about the human rights of other people, including the people of Ukraine. And at the same time, escalating the war against Ukraine, against Russia, the proxy war. And right before Zelensky made his dramatic theatrical appearance, and let's never forget that there have been many times in the entertainment industry where comedians move on to play a serious acting role, and that's what Zelensky has done. He's like Robin Williams or Eddie Murphy when they went from being comedians to being like a serious actor. This theatrical performance, he zooms in. But days before that, the Biden administration says, yeah, we're going to send F-16 fighter jets to Ukraine. That means the U.S. is taking the next step towards real war with Russia. First, it was the M1 Abrams tanks. They said they weren't going to send them. Then they sent them. Now the F-16s. We're on the path towards confrontation. And Eugene and Rania, I think people should just remember that it wasn't even just the 2014 U.S.-sponsored coup that led to this crisis. But there was the 2008 decision by NATO to expand into Ukraine and Georgia. At that time, the Russians moved their military forces into Georgia. They said that's never going to happen. Then they said again after 2014, it's never going to happen. And then most notably, the U.S. unilaterally canceled the INF treaty, the Intermediate Nuclear Force Missile Treaty, that would thus allow the United States to place intermediate missiles, missiles that had a flight time of 6 minutes to their targets, at the Russian-Ukrainian border. That's what prompted the current crisis. And that's the commitment that the United States has made to its people, to Russia, to Europe, to the world. We're preparing for major power conflict. Here we are, decades after Hiroshima and Nagasaki, again with Russia.
It's so interesting because it's like the G7 and the whole framing at the G7 where it was, yes, like I remember there's one headline. It was like Zelensky's the star of the G7, but China is the one that everybody's talking about. And it's kind of sad to be Zelensky because it's like no matter where he goes, something is shining brighter than him, whether it's fear mongering about China at the G7 or him coming to the Arab summit for some reason, which made no sense at all when like the star of the Arab summit was actually Syria because they just reentered the Arab League. But that's all to say, obviously, like there's such a drastic difference here between what you see from like the BRICS countries, for example, who when they talk about Ukraine and Russia, and obviously Russia's a part of BRICS, but I mean the other countries as well, when they're talking about Ukraine and Russia, they're talking about how do we get to peace? How do we get to diplomacy? Whereas on the other side of the G7, it's just this, you know, more war, we have to arm Ukraine more, we have to give more weapons to Ukraine. And also, by the way, China's coercive and aggressive, and we have to do something about that. I don't know, can you just talk about the juxtaposition there? Because it really does show such a massive gap between these countries that represent a way bigger swath of humanity compared to these G7 countries that are just like, you know, the imperialists.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, you know, we said on the socialist program, my show that's also on Breakthrough News, that there was a new era of global politics had arrived with the Russian invasion of Ukraine. And that doesn't mean you have to support Russia's invasion of Ukraine, but we should objectively acknowledge that this is a new era. And the era between 1991, the collapse of the Soviet Union, the socialist camp, and 2022 when Russia invaded, that was a period where the U.S. basically strong-armed every country in the world, in Africa, in the Middle East, in Latin America, tried to with Russia and China. And for a long time, Russia and China appeased the United States. Remember, they both abstained at the Security Council rather than vetoing the resolution that authorized the bombing of Libya. And when Russia invaded Ukraine, it was like, hey, there's a new day because Russia has decided to end, from its point of view, the idea of always acquiescing to American power. And now you see that Africa and the Middle East and Asia, including traditional U.S. allies, are actually taking advantage of this new era of global politics to also find a way to sort of exercise some degree of sovereignty from the empire, to say we're going to be independent. And actually, while they don't approve and support and endorse Russia's military action in Ukraine, you can see that by strengthening their ties to Russia, they're actually increasing and supporting the idea that there should be a multipolar world. A lot of people are talking about this. And you don't have to see the multipolar world as the panacea to the world's problems to recognize why countries in the global South, especially countries that are emerging countries with strong economies, they want to be able to speak for themselves. They want to be able to be independent countries. Like no country really wants to live under the thumb of some foreign power. And so this new era of global politics, so the mantra of peace rather than war is in a way saying no to U.S. imperialism, because the only acceptable answer to the U.S. is more war, as you said, Rania, more war, more war, more war, support Ukraine to the hilt, and don't you dare talk about peace. So when Modi talks about peace, when Africa talks about peace, when China talks about peace, the United States actually considers this to be a subversive element in world politics. And that's the reality. That's where we are right now.
There's this African peace plan that South Africa is touting where six African leaders are allegedly going to go to Kiev and Moscow and try to bring together peace, including Zambia, Senegal, Congo, Uganda, maybe Egypt. But they basically are saying or planning to say to Ukraine that they cannot demand full withdrawal of Russian troops from Ukrainian territory, as you know, at the outset to get talks going. Ukraine, of course, is never going to say that. So again, yet another peace plan that seems like it could be dead on arrival there. So, I mean, what do you think about the possibilities or what it would really take for there to be serious negotiations on this issue?
I think it's unlikely at the time being, for the time being. And I think one of the reasons the U.S. is elevating and exaggerating the world stage role of Zelensky is to kind of say it's not up to us, it's up to the Ukrainians. Where the reality is, if the United States said to Ukraine, you have to come to peace with Russia right now, Zelensky would have to do it, because all the U.S. would have to say is we're going to start to hold back on weapons shipments, and that would be it, right? So Zelensky, this exaggerated role he's playing on the world stage is to camouflage the fact that the U.S. needs to find a way to shield or camouflage its role in perpetuating the war. So when the African countries or the Middle East countries or China or Brazil say, let's have peace, the U.S. and the European imperialists can say, it's not up to us, it's the Ukraine. It's that great leader, Zelensky, exercising his real bold, audacious determination to go forward. And as respecters of Ukrainian sovereignty, we have to follow him. The reality is quite different. The U.S. is calling the shots. It has command and control over the Ukrainian armed forces. It's financing the war. It's providing all the weapons that Ukraine needs. So the reason I think peace won't break out is not because of Zelensky's obstinacy. I think that's, again, just sort of a theatrical performance that the U.S. is using. I think it's because the U.S. at this stage really is not unhappy at all with the conflict. I think the U.S. likes the conflict. It's a moneymaker for the military industrial complex. It keeps Europe in tow. It joins Europe to the hip rather than gravitating towards Russia or China. And in fact, I think it's the best possible outcome for U.S. imperialism in the empire to retain control over the status quo. And if there was to be peace, what would happen? The European countries would say, ah, at last there's peace. Now we can start to increase our trade with Russia and China. That's the thing the U.S. absolutely fears, is the integration of its traditional allies, imperialist allies, in with Russia and China. And then you have the power of emerging Africa and emerging India and emerging Brazil, and not to mention South Africa in the southern part of Africa. You know, this is a powerhouse combination for a new world order. And U.S. imperialism is doing everything, as did all the empires in the Middle Ages. You know, they did everything in their power. They left no stone unturned to retain the status quo. Eventually, they were swept into the dustbin of history, which I think is exactly what will happen to U.S. imperialism and its European allies. But they're going to do everything to prevent that. They're going to go kicking and screaming. That's what makes the current situation so gravely dangerous. And American people need to know Russia's not about to invade the United States. China's not a menace. That's not what's going on. But the U.S. imperialist ruling class, in order to retain its hold as a world power, is willing to risk global war and global catastrophe. That's why it ripped up all those arms deals like the one I mentioned, the INF Treaty. We're playing with fire right now. And these privileged, rich brats like Antony Blinken and that other team of State Department people who never had to want anything, need anything, have always had a silver spoon in their mouth, have really from the bourgeoisie. They're playing games, but it's our people, our working class people all over the world who are going to ultimately pay the price. And that's why we have to expose the war for what it really, really is, which is not a defense of Ukraine. It's a defense of U.S. empire at the moment where U.S. empire feels and can sense and can see its own sort of lifespan diminishing.
That was Brian Becker speaking to Breakthrough News hosts Eugene Puryear and Rania Kallek. That concludes today's edition of Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by the Capitalism, Race, and Democracy Collective. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, capitalismraceanddemocracy.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on Twitter at PacificaCRD. I've been your host, Ann Garrison. Thanks for listening.